What is happening? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock, and we are turning a new leaf. It is now July. You would talk about June Wrigley. Well, it's over, but we got to talk about a little bit, and there might be other things outside of the weather that could be affecting the game. I saw this amazing graphic, everyone, about the drag of the baseball all of a sudden being less and less and less, and I thought to myself, wait, didn't someone just put out a really good article about this? So I picked up the phone and I called up Evan Drellich and I was like, yo.
And we couldn't get him. He was busy.
So we got Enos there as also part of that article. Enos, it's great to see you, man.
Well done. Well done. Yeah. No, I mean, the drag is down. And what's weird about the drag graph or just the drag in general is that, yes, there is ball to ball variation because it's like it's a handmade thing. And, you know, but, you know, it generally has been since they acquired Rawlings. They're a partial owner of Rawlings, MLB is. Since that has happened, it's generally like been about the same. We've got humidors in every park. They've figured out how to like create and store balls and keep them normal. And then this year, you know, drag started out just like it was last year. And then in June, it has just gone. And the graph is just really striking. And the last time that we had a drag coefficient this low that we've had in June was 2019. And 2019 was... Yeah,
that was
went down your spine. Yeah.
So, guys, we're not bad fantasy baseball analysts. Okay,
just the year of the home runs
are allowing more home runs, and we can't control that. Okay,
yeah. So
we're still smart. We still know.
So, I mean, it is tough also because even as you look at that thing go down, like there's more variance on the ball than usual. So game to game, you don't know what you're going to get. And what we got from pitchers was, yes, the ball to ball variability is worse than ever. We got, they're throwing out more balls, the catchers are, than ever before, and the pitchers before they even, you know, use them.
Oh, what are they looking for when they do that?
Well, apparently splotches, because baseball has a splotchy ball problem, and they admitted it to the players in February. What they discovered when they unpacked the balls that had been made in Costa Rica over the offseason, when they unpacked the near a million balls they had to make for the course of the season, they found splotches, yellow mineral oil that had been used too heavily in one part of the process, had seeped through the yarn and into the leather. Oh, and so they had yellow splotches on the balls. And
You know, I saw one of these and I was like, I didn't see it as a splotch. I just saw it as my two parents fighting.
It's a Rorschach joke, really? Okay. So anyway. So I mean, with mudding and stuff, you don't like, it's not so obvious, like you wouldn't see it necessarily on the screen, but you know, I was talking to people and they're like, oh yeah, the splotchy ball problem, I've heard of that. But there was a failure of communication because, you know, they did try to send an email out to the players. They did it through an app. You know, maybe not everyone had downloaded the app yet, so a lot of players hadn't heard about it. I talked to a bunch of front office people. They hadn't heard about it. But we did, in the end, find a memo that said, yeah, there was this manufacturing problem. We're trying to do something. It affects 50% of the balls, at least, that are out there. And there's nothing we can do about it because we're making next year's balls right now. So, like, you can't just throw away these balls and use next year's balls because what do we do next? You know what I mean? So it's like... You know,
only
they said
years after ball. That's all.
Yeah, we just they said that because of those lead times, like we won't get the new ball until late this year sometime, if at all. And if they do that, we won't know. They're not going to tell us, oh, yeah, we're working on new balls now. So there is some part of this is like visibility and accountability that is not great now, because they're like, oh, yeah, we're being totally visible. Yeah. When you got caught.
Right. So I guess my question then is, did this affect all of the balls across the entire season, or is it just the ones recently?
I know that is the worst part about this all, that I can't point the finger at baseball and say, oh, you screwed up the manufacturing. This is what the drag is, because April and May drag was pretty much normal.
Yeah, exactly.
It's June drag that's crazy. So my hypothesis, and I have to be clear to say this is an hypothesis, is just that there's something to do with heat and storage and time that has actually made the oil into an issue in June when it wasn't an issue in April and May. So just as an idea is, like, let's say you take it out of the humidor, and in the past it was cold enough that most of the oil stayed inside the ball, but now it's warm enough so more of it seeps out.
I just want to make sure everyone understands here. When we talk about drag on the ball, I remember that drag on the ball is just like air resistance against it. So the more drag there is, the less distance it'll have. So yeah, you have less drag.
Usually you think about it with seam height, right? So like if you have high seams, you get a lot of movement on the pitches. And then when it's hit in the air, high seam resists the air more drag, exactly. And doesn't go as far.
Right. So having less of it means it's kind of like turning into cores, right? There's less. That's why those go further, is just that it's thinner air. And that means there's less drag in general in cores, right?
Ooh, so, I thought of a theory that kind of links them, because what is weird is that they said, oh, we tested these balls and the seam height of these balls is the same, right?
Sure.
But you're testing balls. Maybe you just take them out of the humidor and you test them, right?
Yeah.
But like I said, you're in the actual game, you take them out, you take a batch out for the game, and they sit somewhere before you start playing, right? Mm-hmm. And they sit in the umpire's pocket. So let's say the ball seeps out and there's some in the yarn, and the seams are higher on the splotchier balls. And let's say you're the catcher and you see a splotchy ball, gone. So what's left are the tighter wound ones, maybe. The low drag ones, but then are the ones that aren't being kicked out of games.
But would we be seeing the drag drop through that? Is it like, are we just calculating drag by distance?
Like, what I'm saying is basically we're selecting for the lowest drag balls.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. Of course. Right. I got it. This is why I had to say it, because I got reversed again in my head.
Yeah. Lower drag means more homers, but
why would they be selecting for that though?
Well, a pitcher would not, but let's say it's a splotchy ball and it's oily, like maybe you don't want an oily ball. Like,
I see.
You don't, then it's like you can't grip your breaking ball, right? So we are seeing some results in play, but drag is weather, altitude, like that's a really rock solid calculation. When I say to you that like batted balls in domes are up 8 feet from May to June, and that's the biggest 1 month increase in the Statcast history, like that still has noise in it because of who specifically what barrels were hit and were they pulled or were they oppo or whatever, you know, but drag is a rock solid number that we have that is just going wild right now, and it's going in the direction of 2019. So hold on to your horses.
And I do also want to think about this I just lost my train of thought. Josh, you're gonna have a fun time with this.
Pitchers this year.
So also inside that image where you have the drag, I just want to note that you have these data points. Are those days of the drag? Are those a certain number of different ones? How does that work exactly?
Each day the drag is averaged out, and then they represent on that chart the day's drag. And if you think, if you look at the side and you say, these are only, it's a 0.01 difference. 0.01 difference in drag equals 5 feet on a ball hit more than 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, so yes, yeah,
I do like your hypothesis of the hotter weather is making the oil more apparent when they hold it.
Something like that. I don't know.
And that makes a lot of sense. And what I am now thinking is, hey, let's get 30 catchers on the line. Let's get all of them and say, guys, if you get the oily thing, don't throw it away.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I might have high drag.
You're hurting me. You know, if you do that, you know, I would absolutely, all you need is one player from every team, one pitcher to tell the guys, like, dude, this is what's going on. Read this thing. And I wouldn't be surprised. You know, actually, you, by putting out this article, might have fixed it. Well, we might see a giant leap the other way now, because everyone's going to be selecting those balls.
It would be weird. But, you know, then if they are actually oily, like you were a pitcher, like if you were trying to throw an oily ball, like it would be bad for your breaking balls, right? It would be bad for most of your pitchers.
They spat on the ball, you know? They had to ban that.
That's like just for changeups, though. Like for your fastball, like your command would go down. Your breaking balls would
How
be worse.
How oily
right?
are you talking about?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
You know, look, the way I think about it is if it's an oily ball, then you also have the suntan lotion rosin whole thing too, right?
Well, they gotta make that legal then.
Well, you just get a lot of rosin on your hand. You're good, and the oil in it should be fine.
Now you got a real gunk ball.
Yeah, that's wild. Well, okay, so how is this affecting pitchers then? Because obviously in June, we expect everyone across the board now to be allowing all the home runs.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's the direction it's going. It seems really bad, and I'm afraid because we set an expectation of like this kind of drag, and now it's changing.
Yeah,
and so you know you have these pitchers on your team that you're like, this is cool, right? And I think that so what I did was I fed into Claude, you know, using my Stuff Plus numbers. Stuff Plus spits out an expected home run rate, actually. So we have an expected home run rate, you know, based on your Stuff Plus. And then we had an actual home run rate. And I said, Claude, like, make each of these percentiles, compare them, and find the pitchers that have overperformed their expected home run rate according to Stuff Plus the most. And, you know, I used pitchers with like something like 60, 70 innings. So like, you know, these are good sample pitchers. We're not talking about tiny sample pitchers. I want to give you the chance to pick some of the biggest overperformers of their Stuff Plus expected home run rate.
Well, and I mean, there's one that comes to mind because we did this last week, everyone. We really looked at the home run rates and we looked at who had like none. And I just remember the guy that I've been just blowing. I don't know. It's just blowing my mind how good he's been. He's on the IL now, but Ben Brown, I would think, because he was like a zero home run rate.
Yeah, so he's in the first percentile, but you know, for what it's worth, his stuff likes him, and his stuff expected percentile is 63rd. So like, it's not, you know, per 100 pitches he's supposed to give up 0.7 homers. So like, you know, that's not bad. You know, like he's one of those ones where like, he's underperforming because he's been so good so far. But then if you look at the other side, you're like, oh, well, he's not bad. There are other ones.
I mean, where the second one is someone who probably just got all the regression today. Because last time I checked, he'd already allowed 9 earned runs and multiple home runs. It's Walker Buehler.
Yes, he is on there. Okay. Brown is 4. Walker Buehler is 8.
Oh, 8. Oh, yeah. 8. I got one there. Okay. All right, give me a division.
AL Central's got number 1 and number 2.
AL Central has number 1, number 2. Okay, it's got to be like
and number 3.
Tanner Bibee?
Nope.
No, wrong team then. Okay. We're going to go with the White Sox then. We're going to go with Davis Martin.
Number 3. He's 7th so far, 69th going forward. Nope.
Sean Burke?
No more White Sox.
No more White Sox. Oh. What? Troy Melton?
Nope.
No. Who do you got? What is it? Hit me.
Casey Mize is number 1.
Oh, but the thing is, I love Casey Mize now.
Yeah, well, he's got a 6th percentile home run rate so far, and he's 80th. 80th, he's supposed to have 80th. And here, 80th is bad, so that'd be 20th, but whatever. 80th percentile going forward. Michael Wacha is 23rd percentile right now. He's supposed to be 93rd going forward. But Michael Wacha is also one of these guys that Stuff has just never loved, man.
Kitchen sink, man.
Yeah.
That's how it is. I mean, it's also change. It's not just kitchen sink. It's change up kitchen sink.
So talk me off the ledge with Mize, because I'm actually expecting a fairly aggressive regression. And there are people talking about, you know, would he be a great acquisition at the trade deadline, and you know, so there's a lot of talk about Mize, but I think some of this is just a lucky
I mean, at the very bottom level, which I can't believe I'm doing this right now, do you realize how good of a season he's had, even with like the home run stuff? Like, it's like a
I own some shares,
104 whip or something, like 27% K rate. Yeah. I mean, this is including the 10 strikeout game against the Yankees. And by the way, why are they not giving them all these balls? I don't understand. It's like the opposite of Aaron Judge. But no, I'm just kidding about that one. But with Casey Mize, the number one thing over the years that I've just been like, he's not going to work until this happens. Mm-hmm. It's not the four seamer. The four seamer has been fine. It's not really actually as exceptional as it used to be, but we're at 18 inches, 19 inches of vert now. That's okay. We've got the with his arm angle, and we have a splitter that's always been like, oh, the splitter, sure. But when I saw Casey Mize's MLB debut, I was most impressed by what I called the golden cutter, which was this 89 mile per hour, 88 strike pitch that he could just throw at any time. And that's back in the day when I used to do gift breakdowns for debuts. Back in the day,
right? According to StatCast, he hasn't thrown that pitch since.
Well, the slider though is now the cutter. So He didn't really have a very good slider last year. It was kind of a work in progress. We're really hoping to find one. He found a legitimate slider finally this year. It's really been there for, I want to say, like 2 months now, and the injuries have been so frustrating because he finally had it and then he would be out. And then he came back for three games and he'd be out, you know, and then now he came back. He had these two games that he's shaking off the rust, then 10 strikeouts, 7 shutout against the Yankees. And it was there. So I feel like Casey Mize has finally found his rhythm, and not necessarily the sub 3 ERA, the 105 whip, sure. But like what I call a Holly, which is a step above a Toby. He's an innings guy for 6 innings, who will have good ratios that you're fine with, you're okay with, and also a strikeout rate around like 22-23%. That's how I see Casey Mize. He's going to be a low walk guy still. The slider, I think, really just changes everything for him.
Yeah, and that slider is, you know, it's got a little bit more movement than like a straight 0-0, but it's basically a gyro slider.
Yeah.
Like a hard gyro slider. And I think that is interesting.
That's exceptional.
You know? Yeah, well, you know, stuff doesn't love it, but what does love it is locations. Mize has like a basically 110, 115 location plus on that slider recently. And what we do know about gyro sliders is that they are more location dependent, you know, like just think about a big sweeper that, you know, you get a sword on or the big miss, right? Yeah. Like those will be outside the zone, but a darty little like power slider that kind of needs to hit the right places. And I think someone probably just told him, hey, you don't spin it that well. He's told me that. I don't spin
it. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
And they said, you don't spin it that well. We've been searching for a good breaking ball for you. Why don't you just throw one you can command?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, this works
like that. Yeah. So I also like that Detroit, like for the most part, actually does suppress homers. I know that it's a little bit more neutral when it comes to every piece of offense, but at least while he's a Tiger, I feel like the park will help suppress that. But I'm still a little bit nervous about that home run rate. Some other notables on this, Walker Buehler, Justin Robleski, 19th.
Oh, I should have gone Robleski. I mean, that's an obvious one because we don't love the stuff as much. And it's just like he's been on his run. Seth Lugo, I should just.
Hey, how did Robleski get 11 strikeouts? I haven't checked that game yet.
My theory is that the last three games, or last maybe like four, he's increased his fastball velocity to 95.
Yeah.
So. And something that I need to ask one of my going deep writers, maybe I'll get like Nate Schwartz to do it, is to really do an article about two strike rate and put away rate. Because I feel like, you know, I talk about the hotel, right? The Holy Trinity equating luck. And to me, that's about really ERA for the most part, and whip a bit because of hits being involved there, BABIP. But there is a luck strikeout stat. It does exist. And that is put away rates and two strike rate to an extent, where how often do you even get the opportunity to strike out a batter in a game is lucky. You know, you do have, you know, needles.
When does the second strike ball comes, or the umpire is messing up, or framing?
Like sure, the same way that Logan Webb is going to have a higher BABIP than a fly ball pitcher, right? There's still luck involved in it. And for two strike guys, if you are getting a ton of early contact, right, in play, you will not have a high two strike rate. But for most guys, it fluctuates between like a 35%, actually like 40% to up to like 65-70% on a given night. So it's like 45-50. And so some nights
we have more big fluctuation if you think about it, like less than half, you know,
exactly.
A third.
It's huge. So, and then you have the other side of it. Great. When you get to two strikes, how often are you striking out?
So what you're saying is he doesn't do a great job of putting away.
So
but
it was a
some games he just gets a ton of two strike counts and puts away just enough.
And right. So it's twofold. First, you have to get the opportunity. And then are you actually good, or like, are you executing at the right time is what I want to say. Because that's kind of what it is. As you can throw like 12 curveballs on a given day, but have five strikeouts because those are the only five good ones you threw at the right time. Yeah. Right. That I've seen that many a time before, where like the only whiffs you get in a game or happen to be the 0-2 ones, but you're trying to throw competitive ones at 0-1 and you don't get it. And so when you have both of those get pushed up massively, and usually that means like 60% plus in either one, I rarely see a pitcher who has like a season average that is like a 60% two strike rate and or 60% put away rate. Last night, both of them were above 60% for Wroblewski. And that, so and keep like in mind, just a there have good, been, yeah.
It, just it's a just, really well done, like a little bit of luck, a little bit of just look good execution.
They just couldn't hit his fastball all of a sudden. I mean, he was nailing it upstairs, is at 95, and they just could not in Sacramento. And we don't like Sacra Verde as a park, but when it's in play, if it's not in play, it's great because the Athletics are not really the strongest.
It's also a really weird park for, you know, it doesn't have the, you know, normally in a major league park, you have a tailwind because the wind comes over the top of the big grandstand. Yeah. It's not called the grandstand. It's like the concourse, right? Like the building. The wind comes over that mostly because that's how stadiums are built. And then it hits the grandstand, comes back, and you have a tailwind. But in Sacramento, you just don't know where the wind's coming from. It was the second best stuff night of the year for him and his best stuff on the slider. And maybe the wind had something to do with it.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. I love that. I mean, we've seen it weird before with like Jack Perkins, right? Remember that with like the wind making him have like a 24-inch sweeper, then another one's like a 10-inch one. But long story short here with Wroblewski, I looked at it. Across all the starts he's had this year, I think it's like 15, he's only had three games this entire season above a 35% put-away rate. Three games. 43%,
and the last one, what was the Athletics one?
Like at 65% last night.
It's almost double like what he normally does.
Like that's the highest. Yeah, like a 33% was his highest one before, right?
Wow. So
not even like acknowledging, that's not getting to it in the first place. When he would, he just wasn't able to, right? And all of a sudden last night, he's like, cool, I got this fastball upstairs, 95, boom, boom, boom. They can't touch it. Right.
Definitely struggle with his type a lot. I know that, I mean, we are a little bit like, you're a little bit more like willing to give a guy his flowers if he's got the good command going. And but like, I think we both recognize that like a sub 20% strikeout rate is just really, it's really hard to find success there. So.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. If it's consistently like that, to put a pin on what I was just saying, he's only done it three times, twice in the last three games though.
Yeah. And the projections are starting to inch towards like maybe 21% strikeout rate.
And I think it's really just the four seamer. I think the four seamer is getting better with it. He has incorporated a little bit more of his arsenal over time. It wasn't just like in the beginning, it was, I want to say 90% four seamer slider. And he is doing a little bit more with it. We also saw it last year, if you remember, that Wroblewski out of nowhere had like a game averaging 97 miles per hour. It was something just like, what?
He also struck out 27% of batters last year. So it's like, I am stuck on him, dude. Maybe I'll just be wrong. It's funny.
I'm just going to say yes, like the Dodgers and it's gone well. It's like, all right, whatever, dude. Eric Lauer shows up and he finds a win. Like, okay. You know?
And also it's weird when you like a guy, but you're like, you're trying to be like true to your process, you know?
Oh, I mean, totally.
I like it. It's definitely easier to watch than like a Joe Boyle or something. Like he's hitting his spots. It's just when I watch Wroblewski, I also see him hit his spots. And then I never feel like the batter's uncomfortable.
Like oh, yeah, the batter's really fouling off stuff. I love that. I often talk about a different thing that you're subconscious of, but that's another one I haven't addressed before, and I really should. I talk about it where like you watch a pitcher. Do you feel like he's comfortable? Is the pitcher battling himself or the batter? You can tell when you watch a game, even if you feel like you're not a pitching expert or you're not really into the numbers, all that kind of stuff. You can just tell if this guy is like executing his plan or not. And
a number of jersey tugs.
yeah. And then the second is, of course, as you're saying, which I really should point out more, like, am I sensing that the batters are struggling too? Right. Yeah. Or are they feeling like, cool, I'm going to get this pitch, and he executes it, and they make contact with it. Like,
how many weird looks after a swing?
Yeah, weird, you know? Movements, foul balls that are strange, you know? Man, he didn't hit that one. Like, you will look back and be like, right, that was weird. There are a lot of times I watch games, though, where guys are just like, it's just baseball's going by, like, the motions, where they're throwing pitches. They don't feel like they're amazing. Batters are swinging at them. They're, like, grounding out, and it's like, you blink, and it's the sixth inning. Three strikeouts have happened, four or whatever, and just go, how did this just happen? Like, nothing. That was a complete blank wall of subconscious. I don't know. It just existed. I don't feel that with Wroblewski, though. I feel like Wroblewski is, there's something funky about him. He doesn't have a lot of extension, right? He's from the left side. He's from 95 now. I don't know. I'm just going to say he's good. It's like the Abbott rule. We don't know why, but it's just generally good. And that's that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I bet you what's going to happen, and this is going to annoy the crap out of me, is that, like,
oh, no.
After having defended my ranking of him a lot by pointing out that low strikeout rate guys have this, you know, these outcomes, he's just going to, his strikeout rate's going to go up and up, and, you know.
Well, that's the perfect segue.
So then I could be like, oh, well, see, he had a 22% strikeout rate, so he was.
Oh, man, Eno. Oh, my gosh. That is actually something we talked about last week where you were saying that kind of stuff. I was like, great, I'm with you. I don't think those guys are going to be that at the end of the year. And they have been thus far, right? That is the one argument against it, but who knows that one. There is a pitcher I have been down on a lot this year. I'm guarantee with you, who certainly has made a case otherwise, and it's going to make this weird feeling of, okay, I was saying he wasn't very good, but all of a sudden he did something, like, three things brand new, and everyone that said that he was great, I'm sorry, but did you predict that he'd do three things brand new? I would have loved to have known that. Thank you for including me, not. And I'll tell you exactly who that mystery pitcher is after this break. So I hate that I want to talk about this guy, because I overnight do not like this human. But he was so good, you know. Cade Cavalli was just like, he threw 2 to 3 ticks harder all of a sudden. His curveball is 87-88 with crazy good two-plane movement. I'm curious what your stuff plus number is of that pitch from last night, because, like, oh my gosh, insane. If you want to combine the sweeper and the curve, you probably should, because it's the same pitch, just a little bit higher on the clock. And he also
look at that number. Jeez.
Yeah, what is it?
142. I mean, the best averages, Jacob Mizorowski's curveball, I think, is the best. And it's like, I think that's the best. 130. It's like 135.
Yeah. This moves more at the same velocity.
Yeah.
This was insane.
87.5, 97 on the fastball. Also, did you mention his fastball cut?
No, you're getting it wrong. You get it wrong.
He has a cutter.
He is a cutter. So I went through my dashboard and I updated it because it's all wrong. It was, and he threw four of them last week. Three, I think, were assigned as four seamers. I changed in my dashboard to be cutters. And then there was one that's a changeup, but it's really not a changeup. That's a really just terrible cutter. And he threw those, he threw three of them in the sixth inning against the Phillies. So to me, that was Cavalli being like, all right, I need something new. Sixth inning, I'm just going to throw this thing and see what happens. And he threw, I think, 11 or 12 of them against the Red Sox.
Oh, it's very obvious.
It is so obvious. I don't know why they were labeled as four seamers.
Whoa.
Right. So the thing about this is I've been anti-Cade Cavalli, as he would break the Wasker Inoue rule. If you don't know that, it's where you have an elite breaking ball and you throw mid-90s or more, but it's empty velocity. Those are not whiff fastballs, and you have nothing else. If that's the case, I don't want you. It's why I've been down on Ben Brown. The sinker has helped out a lot, blah, blah, blah. Fine. I don't expect that to last. Cade Cavalli, very much the same, where he has not
now
been getting
with three fastballs.
His command of a sinker hasn't been good. The sweeper is the same thing as the curveball in my view, and there's nothing else. However, not only do you have velocity where you have, like, what, 25% swing strike rate all of a sudden on the four-seamer last night? He blew it by all the guys. not only do you have the best curveball you've had of your life, but you also have this cutter that is now the bridge strike pitch. This is such an important offering. And he threw it 11, 12 times. And I hate this because he sucks, man. What are you doing?
I'm looking at him. Foul. Two foul. Three foul. Ball.
Great.
Called strike. Swing strike. One swing strike. Two swing strikes. A bunch of fouls. Three balls. Yeah, that's just a pretty good
strike.
Pitch.
It just needs to be a strike. It's a 2-1 pitch. You need the 2-1 pitch that is not the curveball that they are spitting on.
They think they're getting the fastball. And then instead it hits the inside of your barrel. Exactly. The handle. Yeah.
That's all it needs to be. And it changes things completely. Now, of course, one game of adding two ticks. We'll see if that sticks around. This was also the Red Sox, who are one of the worst teams against right-handers in the majors.
He added from the game before, he only added 0.4.
Right.
So he's been like surging towards this.
Mm.
He's got a lot of 96s. It was the best of the year, other than one start against Baltimore. But
it also, I think the curveball was its hardest. I could be wrong on that one.
Yeah, that one is for sure. And that one's been trending that way because he started at 83, 84, got to 85, 86. And this is the first time he was
87 to 88. Plus. Like, what? So this is the question I want to ask, because I always have such difficulty with these peak starts. Right? Like, I remember seeing Emerson Hancock's first start of the year and be like, this is so atypical. Like, is this going to work? Are we going to see something else with the sweeper too? I don't know what to do with this. And we have seen guys have a peak velocity night and then come back down. We have seen guys introduce something like a cutter and then it just goes away. Framber Valdez, right? Like, this is...
I put him on the block in a keeper league.
So you would be trading him after this hot start.
I put him in an offer for Logan Webb in one where it's like an auto new league that where home runs are really bad. Yep. I don't want homers. Like, it's, I could see him homer regressing. Yeah. He's got a tough park for homers. And then he's just had a really bad health history. And then his command is not that good.
Kay Cavalli, it absolutely is not.
There's a lot of things. It's like, this might serve as a transition, but Joey Cantillo before the season, there was a lot of people saying, well, he's got this great curveball changeup combo and, lefties always over the form, extension, all this stuff, good home park, good team for it. And I said, yeah, but the command is bad and the health his history is bad. And I have a couple Cantillo shares. I just didn't go as deep as other people. I would say that people who did get him are probably mediocrely happy with him.
Well, do they still have the
season so far? Yeah, they might have dropped him by now. And maybe the people who picked him up, though, are finally coming through on that promise. I think, what I saw was a little change of velocity and
straight start.
Change in his changeup, too, right?
Oh, okay. So... what this is, what, the curveball cast? Because Cantillo with three straight starts, he's just leaning into this curveball. And I remember talking to you in the offseason about, surprisingly, Cantillo has this big curveball that he can actually throw for strikes. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a rarity to see this.
Wow, 50% in his last start.
And this was a 60% strike rate in this one. It's 38% usage in this one. Would you say 50% usage in the last one? Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's wild. And he finally just started embracing it.
Is
while
that sustainable?
See, Tick Harder.
I would trade Cantillo right now too, I think. I mean, I think you're talking about a 91 mile an hour fastball guy with a bad injury history, bad command, who's throwing his curveball 50% of the time right now. Like,
it's 93 on the fastball is the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, that's true. But I would still trade. Like, think about the negatives too. The negatives haven't gone away. He doesn't have great command now.
Yeah. No. So I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I'm showcasing that this does feel like a newer Cantillo. The beginning of the season, I was very out. And I remember actually on our Pitcherless subscriber Discord, someone being really upset with me. They're just like really confused and like, there's no way this is Terrible.
Yeah, I got some of that too. I was because too low because
I had him like good. In the 80s or something for a 12 teamer, and this is like Cantillo, the guy who can go like 9 strikeouts in a given game. What are you doing? And I said, well, I'm a little different before the season than I am during the season, because if I'm going to draft someone, I don't want to draft a hipster, headache inducing pitcher.
You want to be more risk averse.
I want to know what I'm getting. It's not about the risk. Like, I understand if there's risk, and I want to know that this risk is going to exist, right? I want to be able to say, cool, I know this guy is not good for my team, so I will drop him now. Cantillo is a pendulum. He goes back and forth each time. You don't know what you're going to get, and that is putting you as a manager in purgatory often. So I was out. I was like, I'm not interested in this. I had like other guys that are not that good, but ahead of him, because at least I will know, and there is some sliver of upside that if you see that, then great, then I'm happy with it, and I soar. And now, though, I'm seeing 3 starts. You know, I mean, look, today's was weird. It was 5 innings, 2 earned runs, 3 hits, 5 walks, 4 Ks. He also had, I believe, a really terrible third inning of a walk, actually 3 walks, where he walked in a run and a single. But at the end of the day, like, Cantillo's throwing harder. He still has his 7.3 feet of extension. The changeup is still great. And the curveball has been fantastic for 3 straight games after this being a strike pitch for ages that he's now embracing.
I think it's one of those things where you're
there. But
yeah, I think this is one of those things where you have to have different like plans of attack for different leagues. Mm. I think if he's available on your wire in a redraft league, you're picking him up. Yeah, there's no reason not to. He's in the middle of a good power stretch with the power of the fastball and a new pitch. I love pitch mix changes. Just like,
oh boy,
give me so a pitch fun. Mix change. I'll take that simultaneously in a redraft in a keeper league. I might be putting him on the block and selling him because, you know, there's two interesting pieces of information here. The velo boost in season seems like a good thing. There's a piece by, I think it's Russell Carlton over, used to be known as Pizza Cutter over at Baseball Prospectus. He has a piece called Should We Overthrow? He looks at velocity spikes in season and injury records after that. And it's pretty gruesome.
Oh man.
So, you know, it's like one of the people that did something like this was Strider recently. Another person that had a velo boost in season, that was a big deal. We all remember Spencer Schwellenbach. So, you know, like, you know, velo boost is one of those things. And the other piece of information is really interesting is that Rob Arthur had a piece that said that there is a hot hand in pitching. It is fastball velocity. And so, you know, that's why in a redraft, you'd be like, haha, hot hand. I'm riding it. Fastball velo up. Got it. Good. But that also means hot hand. Like the velo could go down. He could go back to being who he was.
Right.
And there's his injury component. So I think it's just one of those things where in different leagues, you do different things with Cantillo.
Yeah. With hot hand, it's interesting. I thought of that more as, I consider it more as command focused. Like, this is what I talk about a lot of time with Toby's, are just like, you're just not throwing down the middle of the plate. Davis Martin's really nice stretch. You can probably see that the heart rate, the heart percentage in the plate is lower than when he's doing badly, right? Watch is not going to be the case at all. That's my guess, though. I'm going to stick with it. And that's often what I think about with the Vargas rule, is just guys are executing their thing really, really well, and they're in that rhythm. They have the feel for all of their pitches. They're getting the strikes with them, just like Jose Soriano throwing strikes with 4 seamers until he stopped, right? I mean, then again, he threw 4 seamers with strikes yesterday, but then the sinker didn't, so who cares? That's really how I see him. But right, velocity's up and they're feeling great. Like,
I think that now that we get better metrics for command, the better we get with, you know, I think there's still another level to get to. I saw some promise from some stuff that Alex Chamberlain was doing with release angles and stuff, you know?
Oh, nice.
So like if we can dial in, I think that we haven't found the best command metric yet. And if we can dial that in, we might be able to find what you're looking for in hot hand there too, because it makes intuitive sense to me that my theory of command is that like you have to be sort of perfectly healthy to have good command. Yeah. And that most pitchers sort of vary between, you know, like 50% healthy and on the IL and, you know, 80 to 90% healthy in a given season. You know, they're just different stretches of things hurting and things not hurting, you know. So, you know, I could see like, oh, he's actually feeling good physically in this stretch, and the command goes up, and yeah, and you can maybe catch that somehow.
Do the Dodgers have better command?
Do the Dodgers have a better command overall than anybody?
Because it's a six-man rotation, and they refuse to have them go twice in 1 week.
Okay, let me do. I can do this real quick. Starting pitching, pitch and modeling. As you do
that, also, I do want to mention that we are going to have the number one command stat. It's going to be our eyeballs, and it's going to be called the Nakino.
And Dodgers starting rotation seventh. What is interesting about this, however,
is that moving glass now?
Well, but they're seventh, you know, in location plus, and yet in that sample is Blake Snell, Shohei Ohtani, Roki Sasaki, Tyler Glasnow, and even Will Klein. I don't know how to characterize that, but those four that I just listed,
right? We wouldn't.
I would say
it.
Have yeah. bad command.
Yeah, right.
And so maybe they help, you know, they help.
Maybe they're helping them get better command.
Sort of the higher levels of their own command.
You know, it's so funny is the Seattle Mariners had their piggyback thing, right? And the whole baseball world went aflame. Oh, gosh, how could they do this? And my instant reaction before I saw anyone else's was, oh, that's a cool idea. They should do that. Every team should do that.
Yeah.
Because it's super smart. I mean, I will stick my hat on that every team should be forced into a six-man rotation. If you start a game, you cannot go until 5 days later or 5 days rest. You're not allowed. And a piggyback situation guarantees some sort of rest. Right, you have a six-man rotation with a piggyback. It means that you can actually help recover in season, which I think is necessary. I think it's such a huge deal. And you're telling me, I mean, which is so convincing of, right, you're feeling better. You're going to command better. I mean, I think about this all the time of what, I mean, I can remember all the times when I was pitching and just like, I can feel a creak somewhere. And I need to stabilize it. You know, I need to adjust.
And then
it,
you right? adjust for it. And now you've hurt
and
something.
And now
else.
It's not everything. And the best days, oh gosh, I've always been the guy that wants to be drenched in sweat. I want to be in the super hot weather because I would just, everything would
feel fine. Limber and.
Right. I feel limber. It's the sweat is just like, that's all I'm focused on. I'm not thinking about anything else. Like, I just feel totally free to be as athletic as I need to, you know?
We had a show where we tried to fix the Diamondbacks pitchers on Rates and Barrels.
Okay. Oh, yeah, right. Gallen. I remember talking about that. Yeah.
One of my solutions for Gallen. Trevor May said that he's actually tipping his breaking balls. He's like, his body's tighter and he's showing it off. And I was like, oh, his body's tighter. And I was like, well, I learned.
Open up the dome.
No, I learned a mantra when I was a kid. Like I learned meditation as a kid. When they teach you as a kid, they don't teach you like a long mantra, and they don't want you sitting down because as a kid, they don't think you're going to sit down. So what they do is they teach you a short mantra that you say to yourself as you're like doing laundry or doing the dishes or, you know, doing a chore of some sort.
Okay.
And so I suggest that Callan should try a mantra out there. Should try to meditate on the mound.
Well, I mean, you know, he had a mantra. Well, I mean, what's this that? Is 2019. I talk about this all the time of maybe it's not 19. Actually, it was like 17. One of the first like interviews I got with a pitcher was Gallen. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. I had like a Zoom call with him. And they sat him down in like in the locker room, some random room, as if I was giving him like a FBI, you know, investigation or a grilling. And all right, we talked for 30 minutes. It was,
you didn't have clubhouse access or something or what?
I mean, no, back then 2017, are you kidding me? He was not a chance. It was also a Zoom call. He wasn't in New York or whatever.
Oh, Zoom. Yeah.
And so I'm talking to this is so great. And at the end of it, I go back to listen to it. And I had only recorded my own voice.
Yes.
I could not believe it. And I remember calling Alex Fast. He's like, stop what you're doing. Don't call. Get off the phone and write down everything you remember. And I finally put out that article 2.5 years later four and a half years later when the lockout happened.
And you needed something. You're like, oh, I have these notes.
I was like, all right, guys, it's time. The legendary.
What was the mantra? Thing.
The mantra that he would have, though, as he said inside of this, was in the first inning, think like a closer. And so you have to constantly, like, the first inning, you have to feel like this is the most important inning. I need to close and not allow a run.
This is why I think the opener works on a psychological basis, is that, like, you get to start against the 6, 7, 8 hitters. So you get to feel like a closer and you're like, bang, everything's going today. It's great. And you get to do that before you actually have to face Juan Soto.
You know? I just love the fact that you're like, the guy who opens isn't that good. So they're going to allow 2 base runners. Cause then the second inning, you're going to get the 6, 7, 8 guy.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's how it's been working out.
Okay, the relievers, they're not that good. So they'll have 2 base runners every time. Yeah. 6, 7, 8. I mean, no, there is something to that. Absolutely. Of like, all right, this is an easier, you know, time getting into the
game.
This
is what we thought today might work for Aaron Nola.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. But I would say the opposite for Aaron Nola. He always gets burned in like the 5th and the 6th. Like, I feel the old phrase of Philly, which is close but no cigar, Philly, 5.2 innings, not a quality start.
Just, you say to just take him out in the 4th.
Right.
You did good today, kid.
Can they do the whole thing with like Shohei Ohtani, but like bring him back in like the 7th or something like that? No, but with Nola on the Phillies, he would get pulled at 5.2 innings all the time. And you wouldn't be able to finish it. It was called a Philly. And close but no cigar. And Aaron Nola would just always run into this. And I think eventually it was like, all right, it's curveball, fastballs, and like third time through the lineup, you know, there you go. But first inning, I'm getting opener, Aaron Nola. Man, you know what my least favorite thing about the opener is? Least favorite thing. The magic is gone.
Yeah.
You steal.
You have no chance at a no-hitter. You have no chance at a...
I don't think people really understand that as a pitcher, even in Little League or whatever, like
starting matters.
This ball, this is my path to carve.
Yeah,
I could make this the coolest, greatest path ever. And every time I get that ball in the first inning, who knows?
Yeah, right.
So you're taking that away, and that sucks. I hate that so much.
And as a fan, I've always said, like, you know, like, you want to go to the game tonight? Who's starting?
Yeah, right?
It's like almost always like my first, you know, the first thing.
Now, hold on a second. Do you want to be a good pitcher or a bad pitcher?
I want to be a starting pitcher. I want to be a good pitcher. Ah! Sorry, any relievers that listen to that.
Trust me, it's just like quarterbacks are failed wide receivers. Relievers are failed starters. We know this.
Yeah.
So we know this. Bad hands. That's why it's cornerbacks. Anyway, here's the thing though. When I go to a ball game, you know, I'm usually not really like right behind home plate. Sometimes I get lucky when the Mets are on a losing streak and get those plates.
Very rarely. Although this Giants press box is right there. It's amazing.
Oh, is it? Oh man. But so it's usually not right behind home plate. So I'm watching it. I'll be honest with you. A 1-0 pitcher duel kind of stinks as a fan, right? Like it would be great if watching at home.
Strikeouts stink at the field.
Dude. I know what's, you know, cool. I know what you pitch you through. I know what's going on. Oh man, that was beautiful. I don't know any of that in the stands.
Yeah.
If I'm looking and seeing who's pitching tonight, I want it to be guys. I'm like, really? What? I want it to be Clayton Richard versus
Alan Webster,
John Maine.
Yeah. Okay. Like,
whatever it is. Right. Because then it's like a 9-8 game.
And stuff
that's
is happening.
That's fun.
Yeah.
That's what I want. Sorry. I just remember this going to, like, I finally got really, really nice tickets for my brother-in-law who had never seen a baseball game before. And it was at Citi Field. And I was like, who was it that day? It was Clayton Richards. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me.
I took my best friend and his daughters out to their first game. And it was in San Francisco. So like, you know, not that much run scoring. And so then I was like, well, how do I convinced them that something is about to happen. So I kept saying 3-2 count, something's got to happen. And every time I said that, they would just foul a pitch off or something. Or like, you know, I was like, damn it. And I think it was like a 2-1 game. And I was like, I don't know that I made fans for life today.
I'm so sorry. I got really lucky once. I got free tickets, 4 tickets to a Yankee game. And I invited 3 people through close friends of mine who had never been to a Yankee game or never like cared about baseball, but they were hosting the Angels. And the only thing I told them was that, like, the best player in baseball is on the other team. This was Mike Trout. And like, yeah, okay, whatever. And this was a game where he went like 4-for-4 with 2 doubles and a home run. And they won like 11 something, whatever, the Angels. And afterwards, like, Mike Trout is the best player in baseball. I'm like, yes. Yeah, but no, if you guys are at a game and listening to this and you're trying to entertain people who are not really interested in it, you can do this with kids too. You just maybe not exactly the same way, but you still maybe can. There is a game called the ball game. I know it sounds weird, but it's called the ball game. And what you do is, let's say you have like 6 people. Everybody puts in $1 single dollar bill and you give them all to one person. And they say every single time the ball is changed, you move it to the next person in the line. So if it's the same exact ball the entire inning, you can track it. If it's a foul ball, it's different. If the ump throws out a different ball, no. The very end of the inning, so top of the first to the end of the first and to top of the second now, whoever has the cash in their hand wins it.
When what happens?
When the next inning turns over, whoever's holding the money keeps the money. And you'll be shocked how interested and invested you get. Because you are dialed in. Like, throw it away, you know, every single pitch. Like, please be a foul ball. Please be a foul ball. Like, it's 2 outs, 1-2 count. Like, I don't want, I'm the next in line, foul ball, you know. It's amazing. Yeah. You will get anyone involved in baseball. This is my number one rule for getting people into baseball. You start with the ball, change the game, and then all of a sudden, you can teach them about what pitching is. But, you know, there's
slight variations. Yes. Slight variations on that for different levels of fandom. There is always the bet on where the ball lands when they run off the field between innings.
Oh yeah, is it on the bump or not?
Yeah, is it on the bump or not? That's a good one. Then there's a version of yours where everyone seeds the cup with like a dollar to start, right? Mm-hmm. And then if the guy holding the cup, the person holding the cup holds it for an at bat. And at the end of the at-bat, if it's a strikeout, he puts a dollar in. If it's an out in play, he puts a dollar in. If it's a single, he takes a dollar out. If it's a double, he takes $2 out. And so, like,
Gosh. Really matters who's pitching that day. Oh, man.
Right?
Oh, my God. All right, we're going to bring it back to actually talking about pitchers. There's a guy today, Troy Melton, that has been an interesting one that we followed a bit. I don't really remember where you stand on him, and we got to talk about this one from today against the Yankees. We'll talk about him after this break. All right, back to baseball and pitchers. All right, so we got Troy Melton today, 6.1 innings of 0 earned runs, 2 hits, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts against the Yankees. He had 12 whiffs. And why this is important is that the first 4 games of the year for Troy Melton, 7 whiffs, 6 whiffs, 8 whiffs, 10 whiffs with a sub 11% swing strike rate. Last 3 games now, 14% swing strike rate, 17-14 with 12, 15, and 12 whiffs. I'm curious about this because I know I've gotten a lot of questions about Troy Melton. I really liked him last year. I considered him a command guy with a floor with innings who could step up soon. Do you see this as like, okay, I need to readjust my rankings on Troy Melton because he could be coming a 23-24% strikeout rate guy, you know?
I would like to know two things maybe.
Just that,
or about one pitch.
Okay.
Tell me, yes, how much did he throw his cutter today?
Mm-hmm.
How much velocity do you have on it?
What do you want to hear?
What do I want to hear? And yeah, I also want to know how much cut it had, if that's possible.
Okay. How much? What do you want to hear?
I would love to hear that he threw it at least a quarter of the time.
Is it to lefties or righties, or doesn't matter?
Just I'm looking at overall.
Okay.
I would love to hear that it was at least 91.5. And I would love to hear that it had at least 2 inches of cut.
2 inches of cut. So, I mean, you're talking about just like -2.
It's like a plus two on the
going glove side. You want it to be at least 2.
I want it to have significant glove side movement.
Okay. Well, you know, Troy Melton threw 84 pitches. He threw 20 cutters. That is a 24% usage.
That's good.
That's 6% on the season.
Velo.
He averaged 92 on the dot.
Oh, I'm starting to love it. I love it.
All right. His drop actually increased by 1.6 inches. So now it's at 5.6. And his cut, that is his induced horizontal break. You're looking for something that's like a -2.
Yeah.
It was a -5.2.
Jeez. So yes, you know, it was a good cutter.
I think he's dialing that pitch in. I think it matters because what I've seen before from him is like a lot of okay that we when he was throwing a little bit harder last year was like just above okay. So you're like, damn, he has like above average pitches across the board. But I think one thing that we did miss last year that is playing out a little bit is just that like there might not have been an out pitch.
So this is, I'm so happy you said that. So, I mean, we could just call this the put away rate podcast if we want.
Yeah.
Curveball put away rate podcast, right? Because that's what an out pitch is. How often are you, when you throw this in two strike counts, are you actually.
Or in stuff plus parlance, like a 110 plus? Like he didn't have anything that was okay. Over a 110. Sure.
So when it comes to put away rate, there's two different versions. There's the there's the batter level. So when you see a two strike count against a batter, how many of them did you ultimately strike out? And then there's on the per pitch level of when you throw a singular pitch in a two strike count, how often is it a strikeout, right? Mm. So put away rates in general for individual pitches is actually what I've normally, what I'm used to. And I've only really introduced the per batter one this year. The per batter one, 41% average for the year. It was 70% today.
Wow.
But the per pitch one, what you normally should see is like around 18-20% for a fastball type. And if it's like a really good one, you'll see it like 22 or so. Mm. And then the very, very best breaking balls in the majors.
These track like with whiff 27 rates,
27-30%.
Right? Okay? These track with whiff rates generally.
Yeah, they're kind of. Is, yeah, right. Rate. So like, for example, like Glasnow's curveball, though, he spikes it a lot. But I mean, when he throws in a two strike count, it is more deadly. Right?
Mm.
Guys will go more fishing for it more often. So that's a 30% put away rate, which is like, to me, like one of the greatest ones. Overall, across all of his pitches, he had a 37% put away rate today.
Today.
And that caused the 7 strikeouts, right? So it was a slider that got it 2 out of 3 times. He had a fastball that was able to do it 2 out of 6 times. And then you had actually a third time for the slider. Splitter that was effective half the time. So it's varied, and there isn't really, I agree with you, there isn't that true definitive strike pitch or out pitch yet. He on the collective whole was able to find it, but this is to me unsustainable and not something that we should be buying into. Whereas put away rates the last two games, 45%, 46%, those are 5 strikeouts and 6 strikeouts. That's on the per batter level. I just see him as a solid arm and as a young one who is not going to be just this forever. Right. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I see a little bit of similarities to Mize. Like it may take time. It may be good, really good for stretches. It may not have a great strikeout rate until later in his career. It's what I do like about it is many pitches that are okay.
Mm-hmm.
Some pitches that are improving right now. And we may end up that he's like sort of a cutter. I don't know that many cutter splitter guys, but you know, that may be his identity in his core eventually.
Sure.
Cause I do think those are kind of his best pitches, but the fact that the curve and slider at least flash average, you know, and the fact that his four seam and sinker at least flash average, I don't know, man. I think it's still interesting. I don't want to talk myself into a guy with a low strikeout rate after I just, you know, spent all this time hemming and hawing about Robleski, but you know, Melton's also had like way higher strikeout rates in the minors than Robleski mm-hmm. did. So to me, this is some extent being like, okay, this is a guy we coached to his optimal shapes in every category in the minor leagues. And that led to 30% strikeout rates in the minor leagues. And he came up to the big leagues and they were like, this is not quite good enough, dude. You know, like, and now he's like, oh, okay. So I got to get even better somewhere. And I got to figure out what makes outs and, you know, so he's gone in the major leagues a little bit more to the splitter and more to the cutter than he did in the minors. When I say cutter splitter guy, like who comes to even mind?
Isn't that what Hurston Waldrop started to do?
Yeah, there you go. Well, that doesn't help.
No, I mean, honestly, the debut start for Mize, right? Was that?
Yeah.
I mean, you nailed that one there. I have to think, though, that there are lefties. I feel like there's lefties who used to do that. Did Ubaldo? Actually, Ubaldo was a righty. I know he had a splitter.
I can think of a lot of cutter curve guys. You know, yeah. Just never found a slider. You know, there was a lot of right. curve guys, well, Wainwright and.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, walk up for a bit, change up.
Yeah. Cutter.
So it's kind of splitter, not really the same.
Okay. Yeah. Wade Miley, you got the cutter change guys.
Oh my gosh, Wade Miley. Yep, totally. I've gotten to the point now with Wade Miley. I didn't know I'd ever get here where he's like, oh yeah, he's retired, and I forgot about him. I thought that was never going to happen.
you thought you'd wake up day after day thinking about Wade Miley.
with Troy Melton, what's so interesting about this to me is I actually don't think that the slider is bad. It's an 87 mile per hour slider with -7, -8 horizontal. And it's like an even zero drop. So it's like a gyro. Like how I treat the pitch movement plot is I say 87 gyro 0-0. That is your baseline mm-hmm. of like totally average, you know, then you have like the Kumar Rockers, whatever, 84 somehow working. But even that has like an extra 5 inches of drop on it. So when you take that 87-0-0 and you add something to it, if it goes past like the 5 threshold or so, then you start to get really good. And 87 at -7, -8 to me speaks, oh, hey, this is worthwhile. And this was a 43% swing strike rate. So that's 3 out of 7. If I'm doing quick maths here today, there is some hope for that to right-handers over time. I actually wonder if that 30% strikeout rate from the minors was because Melton is generally a good command pitcher.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched this one against the Yankees today, and right before we got on here, he was cruising. I mean, like he executes, he just kind of goes and does the thing. And it feels like, yeah, you know how to pitch, man. It's
like a lot of loan away.
It's cool. It really is. I feel like this is not a, this is, I hate saying this. I'm trying as best as I can to figure out Jared Jones, Bubba Chandler, Jackson Jobe, these kinds of pitchers who we feel like this should really work all the time and it just doesn't.
We're all super excited about, and they come to the big leagues and like, how did we not see these flaws before? And
the thing is, it's very easy for us to just see a guy having success and be like, cool, good command. And then he doesn't have success. I'm like, hey, he's not good command. But it's like, sometimes it's just the same. And I felt like this way with those other guys, Bubba Chandler at the end of last year, at the very least, Jared Jones, when he first showed up, Jackson Jobe, when he was pitching a lot, was like, this is generally a good command. You should be doing better than this. And I see Melton right now, and I'm like, you're totally right. There's nothing exceptional here, but it's a lot of pitches. That's 6 pitches with at least 7 thrown today.
Yeah, and good velocity and pretty good command of each.
Right.
It is a wider mix than a lot of guys you mentioned. I mean, but I think we saw a similar thing with Jobe where he like killed it in the minor leagues, came up, strikeout rate wasn't there, and he had to rediscover his identity. And yeah. I think maybe the takeaway from all this is that it's just really hard to identify your identity in the minor leagues against inferior competition.
Yeah.
You know, because you can get away with mistakes. You can do things. You can just like he sits 97. Like it's not like there's a ton of guys sitting 97 in the minors, you know?
Right. Right.
You know, not as starters at least, you know? And so he has a wide mix and he has decent command of all of them. Then he gets to the big leagues and they're like, yeah, that's cool and all, but like you can't get me out 0-2. I just fouled off 3 pitches 0-2 and now it's, you know, now I'm back in this thing or whatever.
You
know?
Unless you face the cold Yankees where you get 7 strikeouts and 70% put away.
Yeah.
But
well, I can't tell anybody that now is the time to sell because there's so obviously so many things in flux. And then you basically, you know, you had your best 2 strikeout rate games in a row. And so it's hard to be like, okay, now, or 3 strikeout rate games in a row. So now you're like, well, if he's finding the strikeouts, yeah, I want to be in on this.
And what's interesting to me is I often think about guys like Melton. I want to call him almost a young gun, which is I'm so in for 2027 just because I feel confident that a guy like this isn't something where I feel like he's just going to be a lot worse. Like this is at the very least, this is what he is. And I feel like it's a foundation that he builds on. And we generally see over time, something is going to be tweaked. Something's going to happen with these. You know, a lot of these young arms that we get really hyped about and they don't work out, many of them do great in the 3rd, 4th year or whatever, right?
Yeah, but it's crazy. He's 25. Like, like we have these hitters come up that are like 21 and, you know, they rock it. I mean, even Connor Griffin, they were like, oh, it was tough for him for like 2 weeks and then he found it. You know what I mean? Like Kevin McGonigal is just like,
I have a theory about this.
Fine. The pitchers seem to have a way harder time. I looked at the number of 24 and below and they're not there.
You want to know why, in my view? Why? I think that hitting is more about athleticism and being spry and being like, I can handle this. Recovery also from every day. I remember hearing things like Tristan Casas being like, I tore my oblique because I just swing too hard too often.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is the kind of thing that you don't realize that hitters go through. It's really
Addison Barger is happening.
Easy, right? While pitching is a skill more so than athleticism. And that takes time to form into really, you know, as you were mentioning, you got to tweak, you got to change, you got to adapt. But sure, there are things to learn in the majors as a hitter. I'm not saying otherwise. But what I am saying is that if you're athletic, you just kind of roll with it, see ball, hit ball. You know, there's more of an innate skill that can benefit younger players.
I just wonder, I'm listening to you and I'm agreeing with you. I'm totally agreeing with you. I'm also just wondering, like, if I was the director of player development, like, how would I incorporate what I believe you're saying into, like, how would I like make a program that would work? Because what we're seeing right now is just a real reduction of how much they pitch, you know, and I just wonder if maybe that's not serving them, because like, how do you find your 85 to 100 pitch identity if you're limited to 60 pitches?
Did you just hear that sound? You know, that was the thump of my 20 page plan of my binder hitting the table.
So they got to pitch a little bit more in the minors, right?
So I have so many thoughts. My gosh, this is supposed to be the end of the podcast.
we could save
I'll try,
it.
I'll try and say it very, very quickly. I have a general theory that there are more and more pitchers who are capable than ever. And we're hitting kind of a wall of like innate skill that is good. So the market inefficiency isn't the skill itself. It's the sustainability of the skill. Mm. And we have to train in a way that weeds out those who can't sustain it. We have to push them more, which I know sounds wild. You can do rest. Rest is good. But we have to have more intense singular moments.
Yeah,
I think about this so much. Tom Glavine, Living on the Black, fantastic book. It's over here somewhere. John Feinstein, here we go, right there. And it talks about Tom Glavine coming up for the first time getting shoulder soreness. And he thought he was going to be rested, shut down for 2 months. No, they're like, hey, you're going to throw a long toss every day. And they go, what? You're just not used to it. You just got to do it. That's what's going on. You're not used to this. And he got power through and he was fine after that. You know, and it totally makes sense. And that's just like, right. What we're doing right now is we're saying, yes, many people can get hurt from this.
However, so we're just, and everybody stop pitching.
People who are able to do it. Yeah. You know, we need to weed it out almost. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but I very much feel that. Second thing is I think how the minors is structured and how we do player development is wrong. I think it's incredibly wrong. We should not just like have them go out every 5 days and just do the motions. Pitching is only helpful if it's actually, as my college coach would say, which won't quote my college coach much at all, but this is the one thing is that practice isn't good practice. Good practice is good practice. Are you doing the right things that actually help you take the step forward? Just pitching in the game isn't necessarily doing that. I would say you should have like a month like it is in like Middlebury, where you have a focused class that all you do is just do that one class for like 2 weeks, whatever it is. Do that with a changeup. Literally all you do for like 2 weeks is throw changeups. Like some pitchers don't even know what they're good at. They haven't tried it. So you have all of these players who are just so capable and you're not giving the opportunity for a canvas to explore, to really figure all of it out and see what they can learn, what they can't. Instead, we just say, cool, you're this guy. All right, try and do it a little bit better. Do it some more again in 5 days. Like what? That's not development. That's just existing.
Dan Straley told him that the A's told him that he had to throw 13 changeups every start. So one start, he just threw 13 straight changeups.
Okay. That's fine. I'm okay with that, because literally I'm actually more a fan of that than spreading them out, because you can at least like adjust them on the fly. Right. I think you should have bullpens like that, where you're just throwing this one thing, maybe one random fastball, get your least point back, and then throw it again. Like, you have to practice the skill in a way like that. And then we talk about the whole philosophy of the game of, like, what is sequencing? We don't do that enough. Everyone, every single person, just like we ask every writer to give us samples of, you got to be able to do these things and then we can do that. Why are we skipping on sequencing? It's like the most important thing out there. Everyone should know that. I don't know.
And now we're taking more and more of the sequencing away so that the pitcher is not actually internalizing. They're not learning how to sequence. It's getting a sign from somebody and just doing it.
Man, you really hit something here. Watch my video on Ryan Weathers. I just covered his 1.2 inning game, where there's a lot of sequencing questions that I have, because I think there were a lot of things that he could have easily just fixed by not throwing that thing in that one scenario. Mm. And this is really the biggest argument against analytics. It's misunderstood, because analytics is all the time telling us, hey, look, this is information. And this information gets translated into probabilities. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, where the biggest clash is. We often talk like, cool, this is generally what happens. And we know that. And that's a fact. And that shouldn't be argued against. The thing that happens is that there are some people who are exceptions. And when we say, great, there's a chance that, like, you don't do this because of, 80% of the time it's going to be that. And then there are people who are watching it and scouting and know that, like, sure, but this is the 20%. Right? And as a pitcher, you don't want to be right where you're sequencing 85% of the time, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to just take the chances of, like, cool, you look at the thing, like, in general, this is the best thing. That's what's happening.
I mean, that becomes get easily risk out of it, because you're like, oh, what would I, if let's say the Dodgers are coming to town and, like, Freddie Freeman, like, oh, this is how I pitch Freddie Freeman. If your team comes up to you and says, Freddie Freeman, this is how I'd pitch you, blah, 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 blah. And then you see the guy starting to do it, and you're like, oh my God, he's doing exactly what they said. They said he's going to go hard in, then sliders away or whatever. So this next one's going to be slider away. Boom.
And the thing about that is, okay, cool. You have a plan. Great. Now it's 2-0. Right. It's like the plan's gone, right? You have to, every scenario has an answer. And that answer is sometimes from the book. You just keep following it. Or sometimes there are things like, no, hold on a second. That guy is doing this thing now. I got to change this.
Do you know what Mason Miller's immaculate inning was?
What? What was that?
Remember? Do you know how Mason Miller threw his immaculate inning?
No.
9 straight sliders.
That's right. Probability, no.
I mean, it's like at some point, like your coach is screaming.
Yeah, but he did it.
It's like, why not? This is my best pitch. Right. Here we go. The batter's thinking he can't throw another slider.
Right? It's like the guy, John Oliver has a joke about the guy who has a record for most rattlesnakes in their mouth. They're like 8. And he was like 7. He's like, I could do one more. I thought that was great. But right. So that's just I feel like these are the lost arts a little bit of the game that in so many ways we have fixed and improved of, like, what is a good four seamer and not all these other, midwife tales or whatever about what it is. Like, it's this, and that's great.
We should have more games in the minor leagues where there's zero coaching.
Yes. That's a cool idea. There's no, like, hey, cool. Do what Nothing. You feel in it and, like, figure yourself out.
Zero. And so even then you can be like, oh, this is what went well and this one went bad. I wish that I knew that about that guy before I threw that to him,
right.
Then you start to know what do I want from my pregame routine? What do I want to know?
Exactly. Like, you have to fail. There is a comedian. I just tried to find it and I can't find the comedian, but he has a whole thing about his dad growing up. His mom would be like, oh no, don't do that, son. Don't do that. And his father would be like, No, wait.
Yeah, let him do it.
Right? And I think about that because it's like, right, what is the best teacher? Failure, right? Oh, got the Yoda line, but that thing existed ages ago. Let them fail and figure it out and really understand it. And, oh, gosh.
Because then otherwise we have what the starting pitchers are doing now, which is that they're coached so well through this. Here's your shapes. Here's your arsenal. Here's the thing. Here's what you should throw, when you should throw it, who you should throw it to, how you should throw it to. You get to the major leagues. You think that you've got everything you need. And you're like, God, you get your face kicked in.
Right.
You're just like, oh, this is a whole nother thing.
It's just these, all these little things that like, okay, cool, we can fine craft it. And then also what it does in the minors, it weeds out those who can't handle it. You know, it weeds out those who are unable to just take on these adjustments. And I would want to know that as an organization. Is this a coachable guy? Is he going to really do those things to really take that next step? Or is it like, nah, man, I just throw these fastballs and it's great. And like the slider works and like whatever. Like, what? No.
Fastball go burr.
Yeah, right. It's I don't know. I think it's just like it's right there. It's right there.
I think we should let's revisit it. Let's think about this because this could be a whole show. I think we should revisit it, especially maybe, you know, some August show where we don't have anything to say. We'll let's like, you know, prepare like a plan for each other. Like,
what did you just say? When we have nothing to say, you know,
are you joking? We have a director's.
Ever have a show that we have nothing to say?
Well, okay. One of those times of the year where there's nothing going on. All right.
Yeah. Maybe it's a good off season one.
All where I'll dress break, up. All have off a whiteboard. Season. Yeah.
You know, go like our, this.
We are competing for director of player development at an organization and we each give our plan.
Oh my gosh. I love it so much. I cannot wait for this. You heard it here first. Eno, I won't see you next week because I have an interview with CC Sabathia, everybody. And I cannot wait.
Coming to these airwaves, right?
These
here.
Airwaves. That's right. I'll be talking one-on-one with CC Sabathia. So
right into your ear beans.
You just let me know what you want me to say.
Okay? Yeah.
And I won't
Discords,
say it. But, you know, just definitely let me know. but no, I'm looking forward to that one. Then, of course, I'll see if Eno's agent will let me schedule him again as a guest on the show. But what do you have working on for the All-Star break?
Tomorrow is Miz versus Burns, Tale of the Tape.
Okay, Tale of the Tape.
Yeah.
What's Tale of the Tape? What is that?
I'm just putting them up against each other because they're starting against each other tomorrow. I would figure you'd have a stream or something. You're gonna watch it.
Playback's done, so
yeah. You'll just have to watch it and
like a
and put it on one of your shows. But
that sounds great. I look forward to that one. Of course, I will be doing normal things as I always do, except for
until you go on a little.
This has gone on so long, you know. I gotta go. You're great, Eno. Thank you so much for being here. You guys gotta go listening. My name is Nick Pollock. We'll talk about the craft of pitching again with CC Sabathia next week. Bye bye.
USA.